Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I talked to George Eaton and Stephen Bush about the Labour leadership race, the latest from it, the Labour deputy leadership race, the latest from that, and what's coming up in the Tories' first Queen's speech. Then I talked to Anoosheh Kalyan, and she gives us a live dramatic reading of the news that Tristram Hunt is not going to run for the Labour leadership. Well, the Commons is back, the MPs are sworn or affirmed back in, and politics is restarting. And I'm joined by our political editor, George Eaton, and our Staggers editor, Stephen Bush, to talk a little bit more about that. First of all, George, you've written in your column this week about the search for a new Labour leader and the fact that all the candidates so far have positioned themselves in a more centrist way than Ed Miliband. Is that a rediscovery of things that they kind of had to keep submerged during the campaign in order to fit in with everyone? Or is that the fact that it's a tactical thing, having lost the election?
I think it's a combination of both. Miliband was almost the most left-wing person in his shadow cabinet. Most of the leadership contenders supported his brother over him in terms of preference. They always doubted that he could win a majority with a left-leaning strategy. But it's also obviously a reaction to the fact that we now have a Tory majority. Labour did very badly in England. And so I think the left have found it hard to define the terms of debate, because it wasn't just the SNP and the Greens that cost Labour the election, it was how badly they performed against the Tories. And for those reasons, I think whoever becomes leader, they will pursue a more centrist strategy than Miliband.
And Stephen, you've written a little bit about, we've been talking a lot in the last kind of week or so about the unions, with Les McCluskey making these kind of, you know, big blood-curdling interventions, both sort of saying that he thinks that Jim Murphy is rubbish and should go, and lo and behold, he went, and also weighing into the Labour leadership race. Is the Parliamentary Labour Party now more left-wing than it was in 2010?
Yes, albeit fractionally. But crucially, the left-wing part of the Labour Party, one, you have a lot with... So Unite Backed is quite a catch-all category, because if you were a SPAD or you worked in a think tank, you are quite likely to have been a member of Unite the Trade Union. So the overall number is bigger than it is, you know, it's smaller than it looks. But the interesting thing is the new left-wing intake is, dare I say it, more comradely than the left-wing intake which came before it. There is, I think, far less likely to be kind of the equivalent of the John McDonnell versus Diane Abbott stuff that was fairly typical of Labour's left flank.
So for anybody who's not familiar with it, tell me what that was.
So when Diane Abbott, who was trying to run as the candidate of the left, last time around in the leadership election, she really had to struggle to get the support of, and couldn't get all of the other MPs from the left. Michael Meacher didn't back her. John McDonnell effectively had to be cajoled into it. There were a lot of, there was an awful lot of bold men fighting over a comb in the new Labour issue. This very small left flank of the Parliamentary Party, which couldn't stand each other for reasons which, from the outside, looked fairly obscure.
Did in the end David Miliband lend her MPs to get her on the ballot?
Yeah. David Miliband was persuaded it would be good for diversity to have A, someone from the left, B, a woman, and C, someone from an ethnic minority. That's not going to happen this time, partly because it is now an established wisdom within the Labour Party, and that helped Ed Miliband. There are people who voted for Diane Abbott who probably wouldn't have been bothered to turn out for Ed who looked at the ballot went, well, I'm not voting for the Blairite. And effectively, what you see is people voting Diane Abbott 1, Ed Balls 2, all the way down.
So the second preferences or the third preferences or whatever got redistributed, and that ended up working in Ed Miliband's favour.
So it's not really in your interests to invite that type of candidate onto that, particularly because now, under the new system, the MPs can't game it. If they let a left-wing candidate out into the wild, you know, who knows what they might do. They could win. And
so that's because MPs have lost their golden share, essentially. Yeah. So everybody at that point, you know, it becomes much a more open fight between activists and supporters and members.
Yeah, it is entirely a free-for-all once you're on the ballot, which I think will be quite interesting. I feel every week now I harsh on Yvette Cooper, but Yvette is incredibly popular and well-liked among MPs, not least because she's actually one-on-one is quite warm. She's been incredibly helpful to other MPs who, like her, have had children while they've been MPs, because she was sort of a pathfinder in that regard. So she will get a lot of support from MPs, but she's not that interesting. She doesn't have a particularly big policy offer, all of which really matter to Labour activist voters. So I can easily see how she'll go from being first among parliamentary nominations to a weak second or even third among the activists, which will be an interesting.
So, George, the front runner has really emerged as Andy Burnham. I'm going to put to you what my dad said and he said explicit to me in the guise of a normal voter, which is that he's just Miliband but with slightly more starey eyes. And I think the nicer version of that is he's just Miliband but more attractive, or more with a Scouse accent, or you know, slightly warmer or more friendly. Is that going to become an increasingly big problem for Andy Burnham if people feel that what they need at this point is a big break and he doesn't look like a sufficiently big break?
Yes, quite possibly. Because it looks as if it's Labour hasn't learned lessons from its defeat. It's just continuity Miliband. Although having having a more attractive leader isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's it's a start.
Yeah.
Voters are superficial. It was always a problem for Ed Miliband that people couldn't visualise him as Prime Minister. If they can visualise Andy Burnham as Prime Minister slightly more, then that's
But that was the first
thing.
Question, wasn't it, that Andrew Marr asked him when he was on the sofa last week, was it, you know, are you the continuity candidate?
Yes.
And he went, no, I'm the change candidate, in the, you know, like, least impressive impression of Barack Obama anyone has ever done. But he has to say that, doesn't he? That is you can't say I'm the steady as she goes, you know, hand on the tiller candidate at all.
Exactly. But it's also interesting how he's positioned himself on the deficit, for instance. So he has said, yes, we should have been running a surplus before the crash. And even Yvette Cooper, who was the only candidate who was saying, who's explaining the economic factors behind the small deficits, and has now come into line and said, well, yes, really, there should have been a surplus. And I think they've all recognised that, as Philip Gould, Tony Blair's strategist, used to put it, you need to concede and move on. It doesn't matter about the economic facts. It's a political reality that this is hurting your support. The Tories will have a few days of crowing, saying, yes, look, you've accepted, you crashed the car, you've now admitted it. But actually then they lose one of their strongest attack lines, which is that Labour's in economic denial. And if Labour at the next election says, yes, Labour has spent too much in the past, but I'm going to make sure it doesn't again, they're in a much better position politically.
And then we'll talk a little bit in a minute, George, about your interview with Tom Watson, who's one of the deputy leadership candidates. But first, Stephen, can you just talk us through the kind of runners and riders for that?
For the deputy leader, there's Tom Watson, who is the front runner by some distance, who's running on a kind of, I'm a good organiser, I'll get the party into shape. Caroline Flint, who is effectively running as the continuity Harriet Harman. She's an excellent, almost bomb-proof television performer. She's shown herself to be incredibly loyal to Ed Miliband, who she had very little in common politically with. And she's good at sort of motivating and firing people up. If Labour want a like-for-like replacement, that's the one they'll go for. Stella Creasy, who's kind of running... to be honest, I'm not actually entirely sure what the elevator pitch for Stella Creasy is.
I think probably it's sort of the idea that she's run campaigns like Loan Sharks and Online Abuse, that she can get a single issue and somehow sort of take that and make it become a Labour issue. But I agree with you. She launched in the Sunday Mirror, and I haven't seen a lot more from her since.
Yeah. She is now picking up some... Yeah, so Dan Jarvis has come out for her. She does now look like she will get on the ballot. And what her supporters are partly saying is that she is the candidate... This is what they're saying to people in the PLP. She is the candidate who is more popular than Tom Watson among the membership. So it may come down between them and there. And the wild card is Angela Eagle, who is very well-liked among MPs. and actually really well liked among members on Merseyside, where she has been a strong campaigner. We forget that Wallasey was once a marginal, and it is now a Labour fortress, partly because of what a hard worker she is. But she's effectively running for survival. Her political generation is almost certainly going to be cleared out by whoever the leader is. So a strong showing in the deputy leadership probably extends her own shelf life by a bit.
And she's been quite effective in kind of procedural terms of doing things in Parliament, hasn't she?
Often it seems like saying someone's a good parliamentarian is a bit like saying someone has nice eyes. But she is genuinely a good parliamentarian. She's well-liked in the House. She's a good operator. She is actually someone who would be ashamed to lose in the kind of bonfire of the oldies.
Mm. And George, you interviewed Tom Watts, who, as we said, is the front-runner. He's been kind of crowdfunding his campaign. He's obviously got one of the higher profiles of people in the who are outside the ministerial ranks from his work, well, I was going to say against News International, but, you know, generally over hacking. You talked to him this week and he did say, you know, we're going to have to rebuild relations with the press. Has he got too much baggage in order to be the clean break that people need? Is that going to come and is that something that people are going to hold against him?
Yes, there certainly will be people who do, and it does put him in a difficult position in some ways if he's saying we need better relations with the press, because it's hard to think
when
of anyone.
When Rupert Murdoch actually personally hates him.
But his pitch is that he's a strong campaigner, he would be a Prescott-like figure, and I think there are some people who feel that there are benefits to having someone like that who is in touch with the activists and who can bang heads together and I think it's harder though if Andy Burnham wins, because you could see why, for instance, Chukwuemeka Tom Watson combination offers you different
that gives you
qualities.
A Blair Prescott, doesn't it? You have a very kind of smooth telegenic leader, and then you have a kind of fixer behind the scenes who you feel, you know, is actually going to kind of shake the stick and kind of put fear of God into people. The other thing I'm interested in is this idea about having a kind of interim leader. So the Guardian have floated this idea. It's been kicking around. It seems to be born out of the fact that everybody thinks the Fixed Term Parliaments Act mean that 5 years is a really long time. What Labour needs in 2015 is not necessarily what it's going to need in 2020. But, George, do you think anyone will want the job on a kind of fixed-term contract?
No, I don't think they do. And Alan Johnson is the name that's always mentioned, and he has made it clear unequivocally that he doesn't want it. I don't think he's going to be persuaded to change his mind. But Labour is in a very difficult position. 5 years is a long time. And, of course, they're going to be facing a new Tory leader at the next election, and they're different candidates who would be right for different opponents. And then, of course, there's also this idea of having a break clause, so that the leader needs to submit themselves to a reaffirmation vote. The danger of that is you essentially set a timetable for a Labour leadership crisis in the middle of the Parliament.
I like the idea of scheduling a leadership crisis, but equally well, I mean, you know, everyone is now kind of being slightly wise after the event and saying, well, actually, maybe, you know, when the polls looked so bad for Ed Miliband, maybe we should have reappraised him and we should have kicked him to the curb. But effectively, that was never going to happen, given how hard it is to depose a Labour leader. It wouldn't, unless things change, it won't happen again, will it? Unless somebody is, you know, 19 points behind.
Yes, though I think there will be people perhaps who panic if they're not early results against the Tories. And that would be a mistake too, because what happened last time is midterm Labour had double-digit poll leads and people became complacent. This time, if Labour don't move ahead of the Tories in the polls by midterm, people might start to panic, when actually, if you're following a consistent strategy, then it will take time to work, given the negative impressions that people have of Labour. But I think the whole process is being far too rushed at the moment. I mean, it does seem very odd that so many MPs have committed themselves when none of the candidates have outlined anything like a comprehensive programme. Mm. And you really need to decide on the analysis and on the strategy first and then pick a candidate. It feels as if Labour's doing it the wrong way around at the moment.
I think that's very fair. And actually, if you look at the history of how Cameron was selected, for example, you know, Michael Howard carrying on.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
on and then actually kind of giving people a chance to. Clearly, Ed Miliband looked quite happy as he was sworn in, although I hear that he looked slightly less happy yesterday in Parliament. But clearly, very difficult situation for both him and Nick Clegg, particularly Nick Clegg when there are so few Lib Dems around to try when they're trying to look for people in their party. Do you think, Stephen, that either of them will do an IDS and end up taking a kind of senior role within the party and hanging around?
I mean, with Nick Clegg, it's sort of inevitable that he'll end up taking some form of senior role. There aren't really enough Liberal Democrats left.
You might have to take three or four senior roles.
For there not to be some senior roles going around. And I suspect, sadly in a way, that Nick Clegg's stock will probably go up a bit in this new Lib Dem-free Conservative government era.
Is that sad? I mean, I think in a way he did a sort of noble.
I think it's quite sad because I think the reasons why it will happen in the same way that so the Labour Party as a whole has not gone, oh, Tony Blair wasn't that bad. But you ask the average person what they think of that time in government, and they're quite positive about it. One of the reasons why they're quite positive about it is what's happened afterwards has not been that great. And so in some ways it would be better if people went, oh, the Tories are perfectly moderate and fine, the Lib Dems did nothing. I suspect that they won't. With Ed Miliband, I mean, yeah, he wasn't actually that great of a minister from a kind of effectiveness point of view. He couldn't make decisions.
This is a climate change.
He couldn't make decisions. He had, from a PR perspective, he had a very good Copenhagen. From a policy perspective, he didn't.
This is the Copenhagen Climate Change Summit. I like the whole, he had a good Copenhagen. Yeah. if nothing else, we can always say that about him.
Yeah, he would, you know, I think, to be honest, be a fairly disastrous minister. The flip side of that is IDS is a fairly disastrous minister. And, you know, he's still standing. The difference, though, is IDS does have a following on the right of the Conservative Party within Parliament, which means he's worth appeasing. Ed Miliband...
He doesn't have a following on the left, even within... You know, I mean, the people who I think would define themselves on the left of the Labour Party don't define themselves as Milibandites. They're not going to be sort of sitting there, thinking about the prince over the water. Which brings us neatly on, George, to finish with what's coming up in the Queen's speech. I think perhaps the media has slightly under-scrutinised it because we've been so interested in the future of the Labour Party and to a lesser extent the Lib Dems. Theresa May was out yesterday brutalising the Police Federation, telling them that they always cried wolf and they just complained, and actually crime rates were going down. There does seem to be like it's going to be quite a combative Queen's speech. Do you see any landmines ahead for the Conservative Party, or do you think they are just going to get a lot of very right-wing meat policy through?
Well, I think they will get obviously their big items through, such as the EU referendum bill. I think Labour will basically accept, yes, this is happening now, and we've got to just get on board and let the debate begin. The abolition of the Human Rights Act will be more troublesome because you have got a number of Tory rebels, who are such as David Davis, who are committed to the traditional civil liberties. And
lawyers are very sharp-elbowed middle-class people generally and quite good at organising resistance in the way that perhaps benefit claimants don't get the op-eds in the Times. So yeah, I think that one will be really interesting. Plus, you put Michael Gove in charge of it, which is basically you turned it into a kind of bloodbath. It's not going to be, I said this before, but it's not going to be Theresa May quietly putting a pillow over its face and snapping out, is it? Stephen, you look like you were about to suggest another piece of scary right-wingery coming down the slipway.
I mean, I think the law to ban tax rises, which they've promised, is...
I haven't heard a lot about that recently.
Yeah, you kind of wonder. I mean, I'm intrigued by what they're going to do in this budget because they have so many things which were clearly negotiating positions with the Liberal Democrats and the DUP. They no longer have to negotiate with those two groups. But considering the likelihood of a Greek exit from the EU, considering the economy probably will have some form of downturn, are they really going to legislate themselves out of any tax rises? They probably have to. I'm genuinely fascinated to know how they're going to get out of the fiscal mess and they've kind of promised themselves into.
I guess that the best thing would be say, well, actually, that was something that we were going to do because we thought we might be in a coalition. Now we are, as everyone said at the time, we are now totally in charge of what tax rises there are going to be, so we won't do any. And then in 4 years' time, if you need to do tax rises, you kind of go, oh, funny story, Grexit, though. What can you do about it? Yeah. I don't know. I mean, that would be a cynic's view.
No, they could just revise up growth forecasts and go, oh, well, we're now predicting growth will be so large that we don't need this kind of debt roller coaster.
The problem is they can't, of course, now because of the creation of the OBR. So that was precisely to stop them massaging the figures. Mm. I mean, that, so in that sense, I mean, George Osborne could be forgiven for wishing he'd never set up the OBR, given that first they lumbered him with the 1930s line, that so you're taking public spending back to its lowest share since the Great Depression. And now he's got, as Stephen said, this fiscal roller coaster. And the big question with the cuts...
So just to explain the fiscal rollercoaster, because I keep saying it because I really love the phrase fiscal rollercoaster, but this is the idea that you cut the deficit... Well, hang on a minute. You make very deep cuts, yes. and then as you come back out towards the next parliament, then things begin to ease up. Is it? It's about spending cuts, right?
That's right. So Osborne, in the last autumn statement, introduced splurge... Sorry, his last budget, corrected the error in his autumn statement, the 1930s problem, by penciling in a spending splurge at the end of this parliament in order to ensure spending was a little higher. So that may be flattened out now. But the big question with the cuts, I think, is will there be a tipping point? Will there come a point at which actually people do revolt against the quality of public services, and councils are going to be hit especially hard?
I think that's fascinating, because I think lots of people, particularly on the left, expected that there would be a poll tax moment at some point. People would, and that never came. And actually, some of the Tories I've spoken to have been slightly smug about that. But as you say, local councils, I think, particularly Tory-led councils, feel quite stitched up about this, because they know that people won't hold the government responsible. They will think their local council is rubbish, but they can only do what they can with the money that they've got. Okay, well, we'll be back. Maybe we'll do a special, for around that next week. But for now, I'll say thank you very much to George and Stephen. Well, now, in a first for the New Statesman podcast, we've decided to do a live dramatic reading of one of Anoosheh Kalyan's blogs from earlier in the week, when Tristram Hunt decided that he would not stand for the Labour leadership. We are recording this in front of what we term a live studio audience, in fact means four unwilling people drafted in. But I will be playing the part of Tristram Hunt in this, and Anoosheh will be playing the part of Anoosheh. So take it away, Anoosheh.
Okay. This is a dispatch from the front line of Tristram Hunt's non-leadership bid speech that he made to the Demos think tank. The headline is Tristram Hunt's non-leadership bid, feat Eric Hobsbawm, the Potters of Stoke and Brian Cox, and a whole lot of impatient journalists. As Tristram Hunt stands up to speak at the think tank Demos, where he interned, by the way, in those
Gideon pre-1997 days.
You remember 97, Labour landslide, with that song called Things Can Only Get Better, which is by D-Ream. And did you know Brian Cox was in D-Ream? That scientist one who's always on telly. Yeah, him. He was the keyboard player. The gathered press pack is impatiently awaiting a very big announcement. The last potential Labour leadership candidate who hadn't yet declared his ambitions, Hunt is giving a speech
dedicated in no small part to explaining how things can also get even worse.
Get it? Because it's a contrast with the song, which goes, things can only get better, can only get, can only get. And it carries on like that for a little while. But the verses have different lyrics. Anyway, I digress. He's all prepared to give a searing analysis of his party's failings and to declare his leadership bid. Or not to declare his leadership bid. But enough about Tristram, for goodness sake. What about his great aunt Peggy Jay, eh? She was a Labour councillor on the London County Council. Did you know that? And her husband, called Douglas, was Labour MP for Battersea. No, Labour doesn't have that one anymore. And it doesn't have Stevenage. Or Harlow. Or Swindon.
Thank God for Slough,
sighs Tristram. Though, of course, he learnt more about politics from Chicago's South Side. Or was it Stoke-on-Trent Central? Anyway, it was the poverty he saw that radicalised him. What he saw outside of the Ivory Tower. The Ivory Tower is that place where people lived called Milton Friedman, George Stigler, Gary Becker, Ed Miliband and Eric Hobsbawm. Tristram loves Eric. In fact, he reread his 1983 essay, Labour's Lost Millions, recently. A far better pastime than ringing round the entire Parliamentary Labour Party all the time. Anyway, Hobsbawm wrote,
unless Labour can once again become the party of the majority of the working class, it has no future. Except as
a wave of muttering from the assembled reporters. BBC Breaking News is reporting that Hunt won't be standing for the leadership and is endorsing Liz Kendall. But do pay attention.
A coalition of minority pressure groups and interests, yet there is only a modest future for a party which represents only such groups and social forces on the decline,
wrote Hobsbawm. The journalists fidget and rustle. Sky News is also reporting that Hunt will not be running. Interesting you should mention Sky, actually, for it was under that very blue expanse that progressives built a vibrant civic democracy, confronted vested interests, and created the great age of Victorian and Edwardian civic pride. Just look at Stoke. The pits and the pods, the politicos and the pundits, Prospect and Progress, the pressurised public purse.
Let's be blunt,
says Tristram.
There is no quick fix.
As the media begins to wonder whether there is a man imitating Tristram, Zach Goldsmith maybe, giving interviews elsewhere about his lack of leadership ambitions, he gets to the point.
It is a leadership that prioritised the organisational change the party desperately needs, transforming our industrial model of party management, born of the 1890s, into something that resembles the modern world, more digital, embedded in civic society, and better funded.
But where are you at, Tristram?
And it is a leadership hungry to project an optimistic future vision of Britain, confident about its ability to manage the challenges of mechanisation, globalisation, climate change, and an ageing society.
Are you hungry to project that vision?
The way in which Labour leader is chosen needs to reflect the seriousness of the crisis in which our party finds itself. We need a debate that is open, vigorous, iconoclastic, fraternal, and sisterly.
The sound of stories being written up straight from the BBC copy echoes around the conference room.
We need more of the demos, the individual members, supporters, and affiliated supporters who make up our party. And we need less dictation by individuals and individual factions that still seek to wield an influence that is both disproportionate to what they deserve and contrary to the egalitarian principle of one member, one vote.
Journalists eye the exit.
I want party members, registered supporters and affiliated supporters from the trade unions to have an effective choice about Labour's future. And that is why this morning I am announcing that I will not be entering the race to be leader of the Labour Party.
No quick fix, indeed.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. And now for a section we like to call Stephen Bush's Joke of the Week.
So my joke of the week, this is a good one. So the phone hacking trial has reached its settlement, right? And Paul Gascoigne, the famous footballer known as Gazza, has been given damages of 160k. But if he'd lost an arm, he would have been given damages of 106k. That's right. The hacking trial charges literally cost an arm and a leg. Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.